Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, November 30th, 2020. Amnesty International calls for continuation of arms embargo on South Sudan.
The conditions for whether the embargo should be lifted or not, that those are up to the Security Council. But in the past, they have said it's generally, you know, there's many factors they will consider. One of them is certainly the human rights record of the government of South Sudan. And unfortunately, in this case, yes, the government is not, it's not protecting civilians.
And South Sudan's defense minister says the unified forces are not ready for deployment.
We are in the process of working with the unification of the command. We are starting training of the command because you cannot just graduate them without having a new command.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Amnesty International is calling on the United Nations Security Council to maintain arms embargo it imposed on South Sudan in 2018. The rights group released a statement Monday saying violence, atrocities and war crimes against civilians have continued despite a ceasefire and the formation of a government of national unity in South Sudan. For VOA News, Nabil Biagio reports from Washington.
The United Nations Security Council first imposed an arms embargo on South Sudan in May 2018. The Council renewed the embargo in May 2019 and again a year later in 2020. Brian Kastner, Senior Crisis Advisor and Weapons Investigator at Amnesty International, says the embargo is in place because South Sudanese government forces have proven unable to use their weapons responsibly, so the Council kept renewing the embargo to reduce the overall violence in the country.
The conditions for whether the embargo should be lifted or not, that those are up to the Security Council. But in the past, they have said it's generally, you know, there's many factors they will consider. One of them is certainly the human rights record of the government of South Sudan. And unfortunately, in this case, yes, the government is not it's not protecting civilians. Not only that, government forces are often the ones committing the atrocities themselves.
Amnesty International submitted a report to the Security Council last week ahead of a midterm review of South Sudan's arms embargo due to be conducted before December 15th. In the report, the rights group reported numerous cases of extrajudicial executions, forced displacement, rape, torture, and destruction of civilian property by the government of South Sudan and former opposition forces between April and June 2020 in Central Equatorial State. The report says the level of violence against civilians quadrupled this year compared to last year, despite a ceasefire and a government of national unity. Again, Brian Kastner.
What we did is embark on a body of research to say, well, what is the current conflict situation in South Sudan, and how and if the conflict is still ongoing, and if there are still cases of violence against civilians and massacres and forced displacement and the burning of villages, then obviously that means that the conditions for which the arms embargo was put in the first place, those conditions are still there. And unfortunately, what we found is that during the middle of this year, April to July of 2020, was one of the most violent times for civilians in South Sudan in years.
Kastner says, as the South Sudan People's Defense Forces, or SSPDF, the Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition, and the rebel National Salvation Front continued to clash in Central Equatorial State, government forces attacked civilians whom they accuse of supporting rebel forces.
We identified 110 homes that had been burned in various villages, mass displacement of tens of thousands of people, and then specific cases of torture and extrajudicial executions in the course of that fighting. Unfortunately, in Ye County, in Lanya County, in Morobo County, in Central Equatoria State, what we have found is a pattern where first those forces clash, government forces en masse, and then afterwards the government forces will go to the nearby villages and accuse those civilians of being supporters of NAS, of supplying them with food.
In one case, a chief was tortured to death because the government said he did not warn them about an upcoming attack, according to Kastner. Aside from the several interviews with civilians and survivors of rights abuses conducted in Central Equatoria State, Kastner says satellite imagery and other data shows that violence against civilians occurred in Jonglei, Lakes, Warab, and Western Equatoria States.
The month of May was the worst month for violence against civilians in 4 years. So any narrative that the peace process is working, that the unity government is working, that South Sudan should no longer be punished is the word that they sometimes use with an arms embargo because the war is over. Well, violence against civilians was the worst in 4 years in the month of May. That tells me that the war is not over. And unfortunately, again, we've been able to document these atrocities and these human rights violations and war crimes, which is more proof that the arms embargo should stay in place.
Government forces and the rebel group, the National Salvation Front, have clashed several times this year and accuse each other of violating a ceasefire signed in Rome, Italy, at the beginning of the year. The most recent violation took place earlier this month while the two parties were engaged in a trust-building workshop in Rome. It led to the withdrawal of the South Sudan Opposition Movement Alliance from the workshop after the group accused the government of attacking their forces in Lobono County of Central Equatoria State. The government army spokesperson denied the accusation and said it was NAS forces that initiated the attack. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington.
South Sudan's defense minister says it will take several months before government and opposition forces are unified into a national army. Angelina Teny says the forces stuck in training centers for close to a year will remain in the camps for more months before being deployed. For VOA News, Dimo Silva really reports from Juba.
Defense Minister Teny says much work lies ahead, including training the forces into one unified command and reducing the large number of generals before troops are deployed as soldiers, police, or other organized forces.
We are in the process of working with the unification of the command. We are starting training of the command because you cannot just graduate them without having a new command, which is the transitional security as per the transitional security. So the top commanders are going to attend a workshop, a training workshop that is preparing them for the unification.
Teny says the United Nations has agreed to train officers selected as part of a unified command starting in early December. Thompson Fountain, Deputy Chief of Staff and Director for Strategy at the Revitalized Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, says 20 high-ranking military officers from South Sudan will participate in a senior leadership post-conflict peace-building and reconstruction course organized by United Nations Institute for Training and Research, or UNITA.
It is part of an effort by UNITA, through the support of RGMEC, to support peace-building institutions here in South Sudan. The course will examine peace-building and reconstruction efforts in South Sudan and provide comparative approaches. In addition, it will provide a critical focus on the role of the military in national unity and state building and in bringing lasting peace while preventing a relapse into conflict.
Fontaine says RGMEC is happy to be associated with this training, which will take place in Nairobi, Kenya. The generals selected from both the SPLA-IO, the SSPDF, and SOA will form a unified command. Teny says without a unified command, the forces in training centers will not be deployed. She admits that some forces have deserted training centers across the country because of food shortages and a lack of other basic necessities.
Definitely, we have delayed quite a lot. They're supposed to have been deployed by now. They were supposed to have been deployed from the pre-transitional period. We still face those same kind of challenges. Right now, we are at the stage whereby we really feel that these forces should be graduated and deployed so that the next phase can commence.
At a recent Strategic Defense and Security Reform Plenary Forum, Wildlife and Tourism Minister Rusik Zakaria Hassan said one of the factors undermining reforms in the security sector is the huge number of military generals in government and opposition forces. He says the government must create a framework that will ensure proportionate ranking across all military institutions.
In our case, we have now active 42 major generals, and we have active 135. While the soldiers, the non-commissioned, the soldiers, we have less than 2,000. Imagine you have around 42 major generals, and they are commanding like 2,000 plus soldiers. You see, that is a real challenge in itself.
At a RGMEC meeting in Juba on Thursday, RGMEC interim chairperson, Major General Charles Tai Gitwai, said unifying the command and screening the ranks of the forces is still incomplete.
Key questions remain as to command structures and ranks, which will require considerable reorganization to be accommodated in the unified forces.
Interior Minister Paul Mayoma Kech says without cooperation from rebel holdout groups and an effective disarmament campaign, reforming the security sector will remain an uphill battle.
I thought the focus would be on, one, try to reduce these instances, bring about peace within us, and two, eliminate the arms from the hands of civil communities as level one. Level two, you now come to assess, am I relatively calm? Am I stable? Can I now assess the capabilities of the current units that I have in the security sector? Do they deserve to continue the way they are? Do I have to pension them off as an option, give them money, let them go home, and I now recruit?
Akech says the holdout groups must first be convinced to join the peace process, agree to send their soldiers to training camps, and civilians must be disarmed. Without those three things, he says security reform will not move forward. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
On the fifth day of the 16 days of activism against gender-based violence, South Sudanese women leaders and activists say gender-based violence, sexual exploitation, rape, wife beating, and other violations of socio-economic rights remains rampant across the country. The women leaders and activists are urging the government of South Sudan to implement laws to hold perpetrators of gender-based violence accountable. For VOA News, Ding Magot reports from Juba.
A woman we shall refer to as Jane, to protect her privacy, says she was raped at the age of 16 and is now an activist against child marriage and gender-based violence. Speaking during the launch of the 16 Days of Activism on Wednesday, Jane said a classmate who was a close friend invited her to his home and raped her. For several months, Jane says she did not know she was pregnant.
When my mom asked me, that's when I realized that I really carry a baby in my womb. My father was working far away, and my mom was the one taking care of me at home. And by that time, the message reached to my father, and he actually decided to ask his brother to take this issue seriously, to send me to that boy who pregnated me with the pain and anger that I'm feeling. Had to leave my father home to go and start a new life with a boy who not only caused a pain but had robbed me of my future and every dreams I had ever had.
Jane says when she was about to give birth, she asked for permission to go to her parents' home and never returned to the boy's home. Jane says after giving birth, she convinced her uncle to support her so she could go back to school. She later began working in a hair salon, earned some money, and now studies law. Jane says she hopes to use her knowledge to help other women and girls who suffered similar abuse to find justice. According to Gender-Based Violence Information Management System, GBVIMS, annual report for 2019, 41% of reported gender-based incidents were physical violence, 24% emotional, and 16% were sexual violence. At a panel discussion during the same event, United Nations Resident Humanitarian Coordinator Alain Nodehu said thousands of gender-based violence incidents were reported this past year.
In South Sudan, the Gender-Based Violence Information Management System, covering the period of 1st of January to 30th of September 2020, reported 6,295 cases of gender-based violence, where 97% of the victims are women and girls. However, let us not forget that this is only the tip of the iceberg, because there are many, many more unreported cases that we know of.
Nodehu says many women do not report sexual violence due to the stigma society attaches to the incident and the perception that reporting is a waste of time because victims will not see justice. Gender, Child and Social Welfare Minister Aya Benjamin Warile says gender-based violence survivors need more support.
I'm appealing to everybody to invest in survivors of gender-based violence. Let's invest in programs that will support them to restore their dignity, to restore their livelihood, to build their capacity. Let's invest in community-based organizations and civil society organizations who carry out advocacy. Let's invest in institutions that enact and enforce laws.
Rebecca Nyandeng Demabior, Vice President for the Gender and Youth Cluster, called for concrete efforts to reduce sexual violence in South Sudan.
There is a need for more accountability from authorities. There is need for access to justice and rehabilitation for the activism or for victims. There is need for more investment towards gender equality programs. And we must tackle harmful cultural practices at the grassroots in collaboration with the chiefs, the elders, and community leaders.
Speaking at the event, Norway's ambassador to South Sudan, Kaspersen Siv, says men need to be included in awareness campaigns and teach other men to reject rape and child marriage.
The battle of ending violence against women cannot and not be a battle that women are fighting alone. Men are and must be part of that struggle by supporting and protecting victims, by stopping other men from harming women, and by changing the culture that permits rape and child marriages.
The 16 days of activism against gender-based violence began on November and ends on December 10th with a series of activities in all states across the country. For VOA News, I am Ding Magot in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, why there is no vaccine for HIV. That story is coming up after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how do you reward yourself?
I'll go and buy myself maybe a pair of shoes I always desire to get. I'll go and have a meal I always desire to get, or anything. Depends on what I've achieved.
By spoiling myself, I'm a girl. I go buy myself clothes, shoes, do my hair, my nails. Basic things that will make me look good and happy at the end of the day.
I cook a good meal. I sit down with a chill drink.
My work involves very hard work, so I get very tired. So I reward myself once every month. I do that by swimming and relaxing at the beach with my family.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Sudanese authorities have once again indefinitely suspended learning in all schools across the country due to the second wave of COVID-19 infections. Education Ministry officials say students should stay at home until the environment is conducive for learning in Sudan. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
Sudan's High Committee for Health and Emergencies, a body tasked to monitor the country's health condition, instructed all schools, including those with candidates due to sit for primary 8 and senior 3 final examinations, to close immediately until further notice. Last night, in a meeting chaired by Sovereign Council member Sadiq Taur, the committee also instructed all public and private institutions to reduce their workforce between 50 and 70% and allow every employee age 55 and over and workers with underlying diseases a paid vacation. Government offices, private companies and markets are required to provide hand washing facilities and sanitizers and to make sure all employees and visitors wear face masks. The committee called on all mosques and other places of worship to adhere to conducting prayers in open spaces and to shorten prayers by using brief verses. Health Ministry officials say the new coronavirus infections have soared over the past month. The ministry said in a statement, new infections have exceeded 1,000 and there have been nearly 100 dead across the country. Dr. Muhyiddin Hassan, a member of Khartoum State Task Force Committee, says despite efforts to prevent the pandemic from spreading, health workers are dealing with a second wave of infections.
We have more preparation, both regarding the equipment, the experience of the staff. We have challenges regarding the number of staff, but their experience is very valuable right now, but it's still the mortality is very high.
Agri Khamis Alajabu, administrator of the Bright Future Primary School in Khartoum's Kalakla neighborhood, welcomes the decision to close schools.
Some landlords don't understand this situation and they stick to the terms of the contract signed between the two parties. We know it's their right, but they should understand the general situation in the country. Some have even gone to court of law saying that have failed to pay the agreed rental fee.
Khamis says teachers also continue to ask about their monthly salary even though they are not working. Speaking to South Sudan in Focus, Bidur Mubarak, a member of the resistance committee in Jebel Awliya, also welcomes the health committee's decision, saying it will reduce the number of infections. But Mubarak says the education ministry should now think about introducing other means of educating students.
They are supposed to begin to introduce an electronic education system in the capital city, Khartoum. We have resources and good facilities in the capital. They can introduce electronic education to avoid delaying kids with their education. If not, they should learn lessons that can also be heard over radio or TV.
Last week, Sudan Federal Health Ministry said in a statement that at least 10 medical doctors had died recently for COVID-19. On Thursday, Sudanese former Prime Minister and a leader of Umma National Party, Sadiq al-Mahdi, died from COVID-19 in the United Arab Emirates, where he was being treated for the disease. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
Still on COVID, the world has welcomed news over the past month that an effective coronavirus vaccine may be within reach to the public within months or even weeks. Finding a vaccine against the HIV/AIDS virus, which has already claimed tens of millions of lives since the 1980s, has proven far more difficult. What accounts for the lag? And what does that tell about the differences between HIV and other viruses such as influenza and coronavirus? That is also challenging to researchers. To find out, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with John Moore. Moore is a professor of microbiology and immunology at Weill Cornell Medical School in New York and has been involved in the search for an AIDS vaccine since 1988. He began by contrasting the HIV virus with the coronavirus.
Well, they're certainly very different animals. It now appears from the efficacy data that is being accumulated that the coronavirus vaccines will work highly effectively. But the HIV problem remains because it's a much more difficult virus to counter. The technologies that are proving successful for coronavirus won't work anywhere near as well or at all for HIV.
Has there been an ongoing concerted effort to develop an HIV vaccine?
Well, sure. Labs worldwide have been working on HIV vaccines since 1986. So it's not for want of investment or effort or competence. It comes down to the virus. HIV is just that much more difficult by a very, very significant margin.
Tell me more about what the difference is between the HIV virus and other viruses such as influenza and the coronavirus that make it so difficult to beat.
There are multiple factors, but two of them certainly stand out. Virus variation, virus mutation, is absolutely a major issue. The coronavirus is proving to be a static target, which is good, because we don't at this stage have to deal with virus variation that affects the ability of the vaccines to induce antibody responses. It's a static target. That is hugely beneficial to vaccine design efforts. We need to modify influenza vaccines every year to keep up with variation in the sequences of influenza viruses. With the coronavirus, we haven't needed to modify the formula at all. On the other hand, HIV is essentially the most variable virus that we've had to try to tackle. The virus mutates essentially daily within each individual, and each of those variations are problematic. You would need to modify the composition of an HIV vaccine every week. So it's just orders of magnitude more difficult.
What's the second major difference?
The second major difference is that over the millennia, these retroviruses have developed ways to shield their vulnerable sites. The vaccines are designed to induce antibodies that take on the vulnerable regions of the virus. And with the coronaviruses, there is one well-identified site of vulnerability that is readily accessible target for the immune system. Well, the equivalent regions on the HIV envelope proteins, the equivalent of the coronavirus spike protein, are shielded. They're shielded by sugars, which are not recognized by the immune system, and instead of sticking out like a protuberance, they're recessed in a cavity, and it makes it much harder for antibodies to get at them. So inducing the right kind of antibodies that will be effective against HIV is just so much more difficult, and all the vaccines that have been tested so far have not been able to accomplish that task.
After decades of hard work and disappointment, are researchers just giving up?
Well, the effort to make an HIV vaccine is certainly ongoing. No one has given up on it. But vaccine development will remain difficult. There's no simple answers to this.
That's John Moore, a professor of microbiology and immunology at Weill Cornell Medical School in New York. He spoke with my colleague Adam Phillips. That's all we prepared for you this Monday. We now leave you with the song Simulula Inkala. I'm John Tanz in Washington. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask if you must leave your house. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America.
Kara, se me quiere, te me llame.
kana sana la mutu watu na kabina kuna miwaita majuka mazungu na babrika na masajakala gawate galawa ulichimuja kula daba.